Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 3, The Widows of Rincon Hill, a tale of horticultural horror, written and performed for podcast by M.J. Hahn. Chapter 2, An Overdue Event.
Whoa, did you feel that?
Yuki stared at her reflection as the full-length mirror trembled on the back of her bedroom door.
What's that?
Mrs. Fleck mumbled through a mouthful of bobby pins. She seemed quite oblivious to the momentary tremor and continued braiding Yuki's long coppery hair into a twisting coil at the nape of her neck. Yuki stood still, listening, waiting for the room to jolt again, but there was only the familiar hum of the traffic outside.
Never mind, I guess it was just a little one.
The heat wave over the holidays had continued straight into March, complete with the eerily calm and sultry evenings that the locals didn't mention anymore. The night of Yuki's 15th birthday wasn't any different. Yuki had to admit it, so far as birthdays went, she had already had a pretty good day. There had been a full schedule of mother-daughter birthday-themed activities, such as birthday brunch in the garden court at the Ritzy Palace Hotel downtown, followed by birthday pedicures upstairs in the hotel's fancy salon. Then there was even a bit of birthday shopping in Union Square, which the doctor was surprised to see how well Yuki already knew her way around. Crowley was in charge of the evening's big event, which featured two incredibly hard-to-come-by tickets to Admiral Heirloom's 20th annual night fair, where, for one night only, the inside of the old warehouse on Pier 23 was transformed into the dark cobbled backstreets of some magically imagined Victorian metropolis. Naturally, such an event demanded a little extra effort in the costume department. Mrs. Fleck anchored the last of the bobby pins and stood back, appraising her work.
Okay, let's just hope it stays put. There must be 88 bobby pins in there. So what did we decide about the hat?
It's not a hat. It's a fascinator. And it's mandatory,
piped up a voice from the corner. Mrs. Fleck's curious friend Mr. Bloom had seen to the restoration of the fascinator's raven wings personally, and was now looking a little dubious at Yuki's coiffure. Mrs. Fleck rolled her eyes. In the mirror, Yuki still couldn't get used to the sight of herself in the emerald green silk Victorian gown that she was wearing.
It's still in such amazing condition. I can't believe your grandmother wanted to throw it away. With just a few snips here and there, it's a perfect fit on you.
I don't know. I still think she needs more bustle,
Mr. Bloom said to no one in particular.
No, she doesn't. The bustle's already plenty big. Thank you very much.
The bustle in question had been something of a controversy. Since the original belted contraption which supported the gown's rather luxuriantly ruffled posterior had been long since lost, the solution that Mrs. Flack had come up with was a modern compromise of relatively modest proportions, but that didn't mean that the gown was in any way more comfortable. There was the impossibly tight bodice with its high collar and slim sleeves that clung to Yuki's arms. Mr. Bloom was particularly pleased with the sleeves.
I much prefer this mid-80s style to those puffy Lego muffin sleeves that everyone went crazy for in the 90s. This silhouette is so sleek by comparison.
Yeah, sleek? More like squished to bits.
Mrs. Flack nodded sympathetically.
Sorry about that. The corset's sort of built in. Just be glad it doesn't have a train.
Mrs. Flack perched the fascinator on Yuki's head, tilting it forward so that the raven feathers grazed Yuki's eyes at an artful angle, hiding them in mysterious shadows.
Your grandmother always said that an air of mystique will do all the work for you if you let it.
You can say that again. And that lady really knew her stuff, believe you me.
Yuki took a final look at herself in the mirror. The Lady Iwanaga that she had seen in her visions years before, even once wearing the very same dress, stared back at her. A small chill ran down her spine as Mrs. Flack nodded and opened the door.
Okay, I think we're ready.
Mr. Bloom got to his feet and tottered down the stairs to announce the big reveal. Yuki took as deep a breath as she could through her corset, gathered up her skirts, and followed Mrs. Flack out of the room.
Whoa, you look amazing, Crowley beamed from the bottom of the stairs.
He doffed his Mad Hatter's top hat, revealing a mop of sandy hair that was flipping out from behind his ears. Yuki's eyes popped at the sight of him.
Wow, you look pretty amazing yourself.
Since Crowley didn't happen to have any 19th century family hand-me-downs lying around, Mr. Bloom had also seen to his meticulously detailed and historically accurate outfit as well, although he had chosen a slightly earlier period.
Menswear after the 1870s was a total snooze, in my humble opinion,
Mr. Bloom informed them, and then he winked at Crowley.
Just be glad that you didn't get a corset as well, mister.
Crowley was dressed in a midnight blue velvet frock coat with narrow black trousers that ended in equally narrow and pointy black shoes. He wore an elaborate gold and silver paisley waistcoat, complete with a high-tipped collared shirt and tightly wrapped cravat. There was also the massive handkerchief that trailed from his breast pocket. Crowley was also doing his best to hide the small wrapped package that he was holding behind his back. The adults all circled round and began to ooh and ah at the masterfully costumed pair. Then the doctor sidled up with her camera.
Oh, you kids look so cute. Now hold still for a minute.
The doctor made them run through a variety of poses until Yuki started to squirm and stuck her elbow gently into Crowley's ribs.
I think we're gonna be late. We should probably get going, right?
Crowley smirked and produced the small package that he had been hiding.
Yeah, but there's still time to give you this. Happy birthday, Yuki.
He handed her the present while the doctor continued snapping pictures.
Aw, thanks, Crowley.
Yuki felt a little awkward, shooting daggers at the doctor while willing herself not to blush. She had just begun to remove the ribbon when Mr. Bloom clearly couldn't stand the suspense any longer.
I was so excited when the young gentleman here came into my little shop and we found this piece. It's extraordinary, truly one of a kind. So I suppose that's fitting, isn't it?
Yuki's fingers fumbled at the wrapping paper, until at last, a black box was revealed, small enough to fit in the palm of her hand. It was made of highly lacquered papier-mâché, inlaid with tiny leaves of abalone and ornately painted floral garlands with gilt highlights. Yuki marveled at the elaborate inlay work, and then noticed that one of the mother-of-pearl leaves was actually a small skull. She ran her finger over it and pressed. There was a click and the box opened, revealing its tiny interior, which was lined with faded purple grosgrain. Chopin's Nocturne No. 2 began to tinkle across the room, and Mr. Bloom nearly swooned.
Isn't it delightful? All the inner workings are still in perfect order. It really is a little showpiece, isn't it? It almost pains me to give it up.
Mrs. Flack rolled her eyes again.
Oh, you'll get over it, Irving. You've got more stuff than you know what to do with in that little magpie's nest of yours.
Mr. Bloom brought a hand to his chest with a shocked and appalled expression.
Well, I'm sure I do not know to what you are referring.
Mrs. Flack arched an eyebrow.
Mm-hmm.
Yuki looked up at Crowley as the lilting strains of Chopin continued to chime in her palm.
Thank you, Crowley. And you too, Mr. Bloom. It's beautiful.
Crowley smiled. I'm glad you like it. I knew it was perfect for you as soon as I saw it. Being careful not to disturb her raven feathers, Yuki reached up and kissed Crowley quickly between the doctor's camera flashes. Now it was Crowley's turn to try not to blush.
Okay, so I guess we should go, right?
Yuki snapped the music box shut, while Mr. Bloom stepped up smirking and handed her a small fringed drawstring handbag made of the same emerald-colored silk as her gown.
And don't forget this, honey. A lady should never be without her reticule.
Yuki took the bag and carefully tucked her new music box inside, while Crowley straightened his velvet lapels and offered his arm.
So, shall we?
Yuki wrapped her arm in Crowley's and navigated her bustle towards the front door. The doctor's camera flashed a few more times and she waved goodbye.
Okay, you two have fun. Don't stay out too late.
They walked down the front stairs to the street, where the enormous gold Cadillac was waiting for them. Crowley went to open the door for Yuki, and then noticed that she was wincing slightly after a rather pinched perambulation down the stairs.
Are you sure you can breathe in that getup?
I think so. I don't know how they wore these things all the time.
Yuki hauled herself into the front seat, tucking her ruffles inside so that Crowley could get the door closed. He ran around the back of the car while removing his top hat and got in on the driver's side. He turned the key in the ignition, and the juggernaut instantly thrummed to life.
Okay, Admiral Heirloom's Nightfare, here we come. The subtle pulsing under the Juggernaut's hood intensified as they quietly pulled away from the curb. The weekend traffic didn't hamper Crowley's skillful driving as they slid down a few handy side streets until they emerged onto Broadway, heading towards the Embarcadero. Yuki couldn't help staring out of her window, where the illuminated pyramid tower, now complete with its reattached spire, quietly loomed over the bars and strip joints that streamed by block after block. Yuki's memory of the night that she had flown across the city on the Dragonflyer's wings to try to rescue Crowley seemed more and more like a dream. Well, unless she happened to be at the cottage and within shouting distance of Grandpa Theo, that is.
I'm sorry that GT couldn't make it tonight. It would have been good to see him.
Crowley looked over and smiled.
Oh, you know how he gets about parties. But he did want me to make sure that I said happy birthday to you for him.
Yuki nodded and then looked a little concerned.
He has been acting a little stranger than usual lately, hasn't he?
Oh, it's just all the freaky weather. Especially the tremors.
Yeah, did you feel that one earlier? It seemed like they're happening more and more lately.
Crowley's eyes disappeared under his brow.
Well, if you ask GT, he'll tell you more than you want to know about the freaking spheres and how they've all slipped out of alignment.
Yuki looked bewildered, but curious.
Spheres?
Yeah, it has to do with planetary energy fields and ley lines. In fact, that's what GT said he had to do tonight. He's up on Twin Peaks right now, heading up his own little metaphysical survey expedition.
Yuki's look changed from curious to doubtful.
Oh.
Crowley smirked.
Yeah, tell me about it. He's convinced that the weather is a sign that something went all wonky after the Isis Heart was destroyed last year. He says that Tina must have jarred something loose when it vaporized, and he's convinced that that's why we still can't find her.
Yuki nodded, even though she had no idea what Crowley was talking about.
And that's why he's always bugging you about that watchtower stuff, isn't it?
Crowley seemed to flinch at the mention of the word watchtower.
Yeah, something like that.
They turned onto Front Street, where the Klieg lights in the distance shot rotating beams that lit up the night sky. Crowley smiled.
There it is, Pier 23. Whoa, check it out. Thank you, parking goddess.
By some miracle, a parked car was just leaving as they arrived. It was even on the corner, sparing Crowley the parallel parking nightmare that came with the enormous Cadillac. Yuki managed to exit the car relatively gracefully, with a little help from Crowley. As they walked down the block, she thought it seemed a little easier to breathe. Not much, but a little easier. She had almost adjusted to her new constricting wardrobe, but the raven feathers kept getting in her eyes. So much for her air of mystique. The traffic along the Embarcadero slowed to gape at the sea of top hats and goggles crowded in front of Pier 23. The building's classic facade was now draped in a painted banner that read, Admiral Heirloom's 20th Annual Night Fair. Yuki and Crowley stepped up to join the back of the line. Several heads spun around as they approached. Other well-dressed attendees seemed to be intensely scrutinizing their clothes, especially Yuki's gown, which sort of glared with an odd authenticity that drew envious glances and made the other outfits around it suddenly seem like home-sewn costumes. Crowley smirked and whispered in Yuki's ear.
I dare you to tell them that it's actually your grandmother's dress and that she used to live in the Cursed Castle.
Yuki rolled her eyes and poked her head around, trying to see to the front of the line. There seemed to be some kind of delay at the door, as two intoxicated girls, dressed in slightly scanty raver fairy costumes, were escorted, or rather dragged, off of the premises in a shower of glitter while they tried to rip each other's wings off. Yuki looked at Crowley a little doubtful, and he returned a sheepish glance. Shortly after the raver fairies had been properly disposed of and handed over to the authorities, the line finally began to move. When they reached the entrance, Crowley presented their tickets, and the tattooed attendant smiled and complimented them on their outfits. Yuki was a little surprised at the burly security guard who was waiting to pat them down. Crowley went first, and the guard just skimmed over his pockets looking for hidden bottles. Yuki followed, and since she had no pockets, she could merely offer her reticule to be searched. The guard carefully pulled the drawstrings apart and began to rummage until he produced the tiny music box.
He gave Yuki a doubtful look until she showed him how it opened and that its contents were innocently empty. As soon as the tinkling melody began to play, Yuki felt a tiny twist of nausea creep through her until the guard snapped the box shut, and the strange feeling went away as quickly as it had arrived. Crowley looked a little concerned.
Hey, are you okay?
Yuki did her best to sound reassuring.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm still trying to get used to this stupid corset, I guess.
Crowley nodded, and they passed through the entrance. The interior of Pier 23 had been completely transformed. The long, cavernous space was now a maze of old-timey storefronts. Clever lighting and painted backdrop showed a 19th-century city silhouette beneath a canopy of projected stars and moonlight. Street lamps flickered above the painted cobble streets, illuminating the drifting fog that meandered down dark alleyways. Yuki was having a difficult time taking it all in.
Whoa, this place is amazing!
Yeah, see? I told you it was pretty cool. So, where do you want to go first?
Crowley unfolded his night fair program and showed Yuki the map on the back.
Look at how many pavilions there are to check out. We'll never get through them all.
They started with Fagin's Alley, a winding lane lined with stalls crammed with baubles and trinkets. There were also little clothing boutiques selling a variety of vintage items as well as new designs made to look vintage. A milliner's stall was crowded with shoppers who had managed to arrive without appropriate headwear. Even in the chaos of the tiny space, the shopkeeper nodded with approval at the sight of Crowley and Yuki as they passed by. The end of Fagin's Alley connected to a larger boulevard, and then they stumbled upon their first tented pavilion, the Hall of Comestibles. Upon entering, the smell of sizzling meats wafted from the direction of Mrs. Lovett's roastery, which featured a vast assortment of pasties and pies. There were a few Mrs. Lovett's offering trays loaded with free samples of their special of the day, something that boasted an equally special mystery filling. Yuki shot a nervous glance at Crowley and he laughed.
Probably a good idea if we just skip those, okay?
Yuki gave her head a little relieved nod as they continued. Further along the pavilion, they came upon Miss Havisham's confectionery, where a highly powdered woman in a ragged antique wedding dress was selling little cakes, each with an icing sugar mouse perched on top and nibbling at the frosting. There already seemed to be a lot of noise coming from the far corner of the marquee, where a crisscross of fairy lights sheltered several long trestle tables. Overhead, a painted banner read, Fortunato's Garden of the Spirits. Several inebriated patrons were throwing back tankards of ale and glasses of fine wines. Crowley deflated a little when he read the sign that said, Over 21 only. No ID, no Amontillado. Perhaps if he had been keeping up with his hocus-pocus practice, he could have used a little sorcery to temporarily adjust the birth date on his driver's license. As such, they had to content themselves with two ginger beers and a seat under the twinkling canopy of tiny lights. Yuki was glad for a place to sit, as she suddenly realized that her feet were killing her. Crowley sipped at his mug while he scanned through the night fair's program.
There's still so much to check out. Listen to this. The Brothers Archimedes Mechanical Marveltorium. Looks like they've got a life-size Rock'em Sock'em Robots thing where you can be Edison or Tesla and pummel each other. Or there's Blackheart's Palace of Chance. Looks like carnival games or something. There's a bunch of different art exhibitions at Saravashti's Galleria. And what's this? Chesterfield's Hall of Soft Furnishings?
At a loss for words, Yuki merely sipped her ginger beer when Crowley's face suddenly lit up.
Hey, look at this! The Djinn Rebellion is playing right now on the Midnight Sepulchre stage. Cool.
Yuki set her mug down.
The Djinn Rebellion? What's that?
They're a band. Come on, we can still make it. We should go check them out.
Crowley stood from the table and offered a helping hand. And despite the protests of her tired feet, Yuki found herself led back through the maze of crowded winding streets until they made their way to the Music Pavilion and the Midnight Sepulchre stage. A large crowd had gathered, and there was a little difficulty finding a spot where Yuki could actually see the stage, which was the height of Victorian funereal elegance. The audience burst into rapid applause as a rather tall and burly man took the stage. He wore a floor-length leather duster and a tall plumed bicorn hat, from under which grew a mass of salt and pepper dreadlocks that reached clear to his waist. His face was largely hidden behind mirrored goggles and a silver beard of epically Zeusian proportions. Crowley smiled.
That's him! That's Admiral Heirloom!
Admiral Heirloom waved to the crowd, made a few perfunctory bows, and spoke into the mic.
Thank you, thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, madame and messieurs. As our non-stop nocturne continues, it gives me great pleasure to present a truly stupendous trio, making their San Francisco debut all the way from the not-so-lost city of Atlanta. May I present the Gin Rebellion.
The crowd fell silent as the house lights dimmed. A shining black accordion suddenly gleamed in the bright spotlight. The hollow-eyed accordionist began to play with the devil's sway in his spine. He was joined by a dark-haired beauty who had a single rose fixed to the head of her guitar. Then a tall figure lithely slipped into the spotlight, brandishing his vintage Unidyne microphone. Crowley double-checked his program.
So the accordion guy is Renfield? Ophelia plays the guitar, and HM on vocals.
Yuki nodded as the song began.
The music hall is where it all begins, where a man sat playing his black accordion. Everybody watched as he went up to his seat, but he fell to his knees as he went up to a knee. That accordion groaned with a resounding shrill. You knew it right away that it was out to kill. And before you knew it, there wasn't a sound. And that's when everybody fell to the ground. Well, the sky turned black, lightning struck all around. Terror broke out in every part of town. All the people cried out, but didn't know even then. It's the attack of the evil haunted accordion. So the few survivors gathered what they could. They rounded up supplies, looting liquor and food. They packed the accordion, looking to sell. But little did they know that it was straight from hell. The word traveled fast about that fateful night, and a lack of a killer left a terrible fright. They thought it suspicious, but it won't happen again. It couldn't have been that black accordion. So they sold it to a man, a traveling magician, and a circus of freaks. They were in poor condition. They thought that the music would play nice and loud. And that night as they drew in a crowd, that accordion groaned with a resounding shrill. You knew it right away that it was out to kill. And before you knew it, there wasn't a sound. And that's when everybody fell to the ground. Well, the sky turned black, lightning struck all around. Terror broke out in every part of town. All the people cried out, oh no, not again. It's the attack of the evil haunted accordion. As the legend grew of its demonic tone, not a scoundrel alive couldn't leave it alone. As the body stacked up again and again, they knew it had to be that black accordion. When that accordion groans with a resounding shrill, you know it right away that it is out to kill. And before you know it, there isn't a sound. And that's when everybody fell to the ground. Well, the sky turned black, lightning struck all around. Terror broke out in every part of town. All the people cried out, oh no, not again. It's the attack of the evil haunted accordion. It's the attack of the evil. The attack of the evil lie. The attack of the evil haunted.
As the song reached its conclusion, Yuki thought that she could also hear the strains of Chopin tinkling from inside her handbag. She looked down and undid the drawstring to investigate. The music box was still safely nestled at the bottom of her bag, but the tinkling melody didn't make any sense because the music box was definitely shut tight. Puzzled, Yuki reached inside, and as soon as her fingers clasped around the tiny box, there was a sudden and distinct jolt that sent the lights swaying and a murmur of panic traveling through the crowd. Then a deep rumbling sound, followed by an ominous crack that ran down the length of the pier. In all the shaking, as plywood facades began to crumble and the crowd scattered in all directions, the Jin Rebellion gathered up their instruments and beat a hasty retreat for the exits. Crowley grabbed Yuki's hand and then noticed her expression.
"Come on, we should get out of here! Hey, what's wrong with you? Are you okay?"
Yuki seemed to be swaying on the spot. Her eyes had a distant and unfocused look.
"Oh, I feel a little strange."
Then another tremor, more violent than the last, shook underfoot. This time the lights went out completely, adding to the chaos and screaming panic as people fought to escape. In the darkness, Crowley lost hold of Yuki's hand, and he reached around in vain, blindly trying to find her.
"Yuki? Yuki, where are you? Yuki?"
Amid the clamor, Crowley's blood turned to ice when he finally heard Yuki's voice cry out.
Crowley!
Her cry seemed to sustain unnaturally, and then was abruptly cut off. Almost immediately, the shaking stopped, and the lights came on again. Crowley found himself standing alone as the crowd diminished. He stared down at the floor to the spot where the tiny music box lay abandoned. It sat open on its side, its tinkling melody cheerfully playing away. Crowley's head spun around and a panicked expression spread across his face.
"Yuki? Yuki? Where did she go?"
He stared desperately, hoping to catch a glimpse of emerald silk. But Yuki was nowhere to be seen. Theodorus Golden reached out to steady his theodolite as he watched the lights blink out block by block across the city. Even high on top of Twin Peaks, he had felt the sudden jolt, followed by a series of subsiding tremors. He looked through the eyepiece again and shuddered with a start, refusing to believe what his eyes were showing him. Needless to say, he had never seen anything like it.
"What the? How could that be? They're warping."
His head popped up and he appraised the theodolite's controls, flipping through several combinations of lenses while adjusting the antique device's micrometer. He returned to the eyepiece and exhaled sharply. Ordinarily, there was only a vague impression of a north-south ley line which ran through the distant hills of the East Bay. Now it was bending at an angle that made it cross directly in the path of the Pyramid Tower downtown. Theodorus adjusted his micrometer again as another tremor rumbled underfoot. He steadied himself, returned to the eyepiece, and then gasped. Where before there had only been one ley line tangled up in the pyramid's path, now there were two. Another had somehow altered its usual position from somewhere over the Pacific, far to the west. Theodorus frowned as he looked out over the city. He knew in his heart of hearts that it was no accident that the ley lines were intersecting directly in the center of the Pyramid Tower's newly reattached spire. Chapter 2 comes to a close. Special thanks go to guest voices on this episode, Sally Clausen as the Doctor, Jennifer Viale as Mrs. Flack, and Leanne Parker as Yuki. And extra special thanks go to the Jin Rebellion for the use of their track, The Attack of the Evil Haunted Accordion. For more information on the Jin Rebellion, please check out their website, thejinrebellion.com. You can also visit their fan page on Facebook, Music on the program provided by freesound.org and at comtech.com. Please stay tuned for Chapter 3. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.